So next up, we have another member emeritus of the Nerdalogs, very good friend of mine, Andrew Bentley! Yay!
Hi, I'm Andrew Bentley. In a Venn diagram wherein one side is labeled hate fucking and the other side star fucking, my trip to the summer meeting of the RNC in Chicago this year was right in the fucking middle. In the grand political tradition, I was only able to attend through nepotism, as my great aunt has been a member of the committee since the halcyon days of Reagan's Morning in America. Well, America is much darker now, which is, of course, why we need voter ID laws. Delay on that one. American skies are darker now. But my aunt still serves as the chairwoman of Republicans for Choice, with all the doomed nobility of a helmsman on the Titanic, pulling at a smashed rudder, politely confirming the captain's course as icy water floods the lower decks and drowns all the Irish. The invitation is given in a spirit of well-meaning but misguided evangelism, and I'm only too eager to attend. For a few days, at least, it seems, I'll get to be Matthew Taibbi or Hunter S. Thompson, the spitting cobras of political journalism, soaking in the calliope music of the most demented circus this side of a Rob Zombie video. I announce my plans with glee on Facebook, unperturbed that no one seems to particularly care outside of one old friend who tells me to ask RNC chair Reince Priebus what his name is an anagram for. The night before, my eye is already twitching in anticipatory rage at the Caligulan pageantry that will no doubt be forthcoming. I forsake my regular coffee as I set out that morning, fueled only by the promise of schadenfreude and apoplexy as I step into the Westin Hotel lobby and make my way up to the second floor. The friendly young women at the conference room door check my pass, and in I go, feeling very much like Lee Marvin in The Dirty Dozen. I find my aunt's table and join her there, tucked away at the back of the room, presumably to give security time to intercept her in the event she rushes the stage and attempts to abort one of the speakers. Ironically, the speaker has already aborted of their own accord. Dick Cheney's plane has been delayed, and he will not be arriving in time for these opening ceremonies. But as there must always be a Stark in Winterfell, we are assured first that Lynn Cheney will be speaking in his place, then, correction, Liz Cheney. A lineup change which is met with much the same reaction as if they'd announced that at tonight's show, Pantera would be replaced by Oingo Boingo. As the announcement is made, a wave of eye-rolling washes through the crowd of such severity that I grip the tablecloth, terrified that the entire hotel might lurch suddenly to the side. I'm somewhat mystified at the reaction, and for the first time, I really look at my fellow attendees. It's hard to say exactly what I'm expecting, short of a detail from Hieronymus Bosch. Some of it is accurate, no prolapsing bird kings or ass-trumpeting demons, but there are the pallid old men and Botoxed old women, the Weasley-looking young Republicans and their homogenous appendage of pretty blonde wife. But in equal proportion are friendly nebbishes and kindly wheelchair-bound grandmothers, young black women in smart pantsuits and a pair of gentlemen in pinstriped seersucker and straw butter hats who I immediately assume, and correctly I will learn, are the representatives from Georgia. At my very table sit two tanned and healthy-looking visitors from South Dakota, commiserating with genuine rue that chickens were all raised in a box these days and that liberals won't let you smoke in bars anymore. By the time failed senatorial carpetbagger Liz Cheney has taken the stage, I am already glumly consigned to the reality that I will be forced to judge my fellow conference-goers as individual human beings rather than as a single monstrous organ. Still, here is such a human being for me to judge. Her speech is a litany of all the most contemptible sound bites I have forecast, dismissing the very idea of a war on women exhortations that we must continue to block Obama's policy and that that is patriotism, not obstructionism, indignant moaning over the great lies of Benghazi, and then down the rabbit hole. Our freedom is under assault from Washington in a way unknown in my lifetime. Follows fast on her heels of a tone-deaf anecdote about her daughter who couldn't have a horse as a child. The moral of this parable is unclear, but now she assures us she has two horses. Instinctively, I touched the cut on my cheek where I shaved that morning with a dull razor because I couldn't afford new ones yet. But then we're on to foreign policy, and foreign it is, to all reason and moderation. We've never tortured anybody, she claims, explaining how our own operatives are required to undergo waterboarding before they inflict it on anyone else, and somehow invoking 9/11 all in the same breath. She describes Obama's anti-terrorism efforts, including trials and Miranda rights, and it takes me a good minute to realize I'm supposed to see these as negatives. We must reverse Obama's devastating defense cuts. John Kerry meeting with the Turks is an insult to Israel. Under Obama, she pleads, we don't even have interrogations anymore. When she leaves the stage, she's trailed by modest applause and the lingering stench of the abattoir. And for a moment, I return to my initial expectations of horrific extremism. But this has just been a freak storm. The rest of the day passes in relative monotony. There are presentations, of course, plenty of statistics on outreach and fundraising. And as a political junkie, I'm interested, but I know it's nothing to stir the blood. Many of the RNC members seem to agree. As I sit in the back of a third conference hall during a presentation on their efforts to duplicate the Obama fundraising machine, idly gnawing on a complimentary pretzel stick, I glance forward to see a representative from Maryland playing Ebony on his computer. I feel a brief moment of envy and consider why I'm spending a beautiful Saturday inside like this. Because I care. I tell myself, because this is important. At a panel for up-and-coming Republican stars, a black man, an Asian American, and a woman, questions include, what does EPA overreach mean for the war on coal? And where has the Obama foreign policy gone wrong? If they were begging the question any harder, Rudy Giuliani would have them deported to Jersey. But all I can muster is a wry chuckle. That evening at the Field Museum, I drink my free mid-shelf whiskey and watch Mike Pence and Mark Kirk and other Midwest Republicans give their speeches, and honestly, they sound like pretty nice guys. And when at dinner, Dick Cheney himself arrives, the angel of death in a cowboy hat and Garamond eyeglasses. My aunt takes a picture as I watch him extol in between hacking coughs every philosophical stance I abhor. She sends me the shot in an email. Just wanted proof you and Dick Cheney were in the same room, the caption reads. I look at my steak knife, ponder the distance to the stage, and how easy it really is to throw your life away. And then I simply eat my meatloaf. It's delicious. My trip home that night is somber. I discuss with my aunt my own misgivings about the AHCA and disappointment with Obama. She nods in understanding when I explain that doesn't mean I agree with her party. After all, oftentimes she doesn't either, but she shows up anyway to continue her slow assault on the glass ceiling and to try and protect some of the more moderate members from Tea Party primaries. She admits that she's getting tired of it after all these years. And as I slip wearily out of my tie and suspenders, I admit to myself finally that that's the true cost of political change. Boredom. When the Cheneys and Perrys and Bachmans of the world step down off their stages, my grand circus isn't really any different than a long afternoon meeting at any white-collar job I've ever had, except the stats and charts and buzzwords are tied up in billions of dollars and the future of our country. My head hurts, and I have to get up tomorrow morning to go back. We take regional brunch with the New Englanders, even though as a Virginia resident my aunt should meet with the Southern Coalition, but she knows that's a non-starter. Here she has friends. They're nice people, and as they lay out their plans for fundraising, even in lost cause states like Delaware and Vermont, I find myself rooting for them. A gentleman from New York, an old friend of my aunt's, gives me his card when he finds out I'm a comedian. Give me a call, he says. We could use more charismatic young people in the party. I touch the cut on my cheek again, and I pocket the card. As I take yet another trip to the bathroom to purge some of the free coffee I've been swilling, I feel defeated and vaguely foolish. It's another beautiful day out, but I won't see much of it. Wanting a moment alone with my thoughts, I take a stroll to the bathroom at the far end of the floor, and there, at the urinal next to me, is the man himself, Rance Priebus. He nods curtly at me. How you doing? He asks. Pretty well, yourself? Not bad. A pause. Hey, I promised a friend I'd asked. What exactly is your name an anagram for? There's a moment of silence as he finishes washing his hands, and he gives a forced chuckle. You have a great day now, okay? And he's gone. The next time I see him, he'll be up on stage, calling to order the voting meeting for this year's RNC. But if I look closely, I think he seems a little pissed off. A little frazzled. I smile, grab some more coffee, and settle in to watch the show. It's a beautiful summer day in Chicago, and this cobra can still spit. Thank you.
I don't remember where I was when Andrew texted me that he did that, but I do remember I made everyone stop what they were doing and listen to me read that text message. It was a great moment.